It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about the hostility, harassment, and threats women face in the online world.
But first, we're talking about a post-game interview with a football player that's gotten a lot of people talking.
On Sunday, the Seattle Seahawks beat the San Francisco 49ers, sealing a trip to the Super Bowl. The game was hard-fought and exciting. But what really got people going was an interview with the player who made the game-winning play, Richard Sherman.
We have Greg Easterbrook with us now to talk about this emotionally charged interview and what it means that we're obsessing over it. Greg Easterbrook is a contributing editor of The Atlantic and author of The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America.
First, we'll play that interview for you. Here's Aaron Andrews interviewing Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman.
The final play, take me through it.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
Who was talking about you?
Crabtree, don't you open your mouth about the best. Or I'm going to shut it for you real quick. L.O.B.
All right, before... And Joe, back over to you.
That rant is from Seattle Seahawks cornerback Richard Sherman. It came right after Sherman made a pretty dramatic play. Can you break down what happened during that play?
Well, it was a lovely play. He knocked down a pass that was what we call a stutter fade in NFL terminology talk, and the receiver was open. He took the inside position to force the quarterback to throw over him. He knocked it down, and he not only knocked it down, he knocked it to his own teammate, intercepting the ball, ending the game.
And not only that, he made sure the Seahawks are going to the Super Bowl, right?
Yes, it was the play that sealed the Seattle trip to the Super Bowl, which, of course, is not in New York. It's in New Jersey, so we're calling it the Jersey Bowl on the East Coast.
So this is not just an ordinary play. This is the kind of play that people are pumped about, the players and the fans and everybody who's there who's rooting for the Seahawks, right?
Oh, yeah, very exciting moment, especially if you were a supporter of that team. But there aren't that many times when the team that makes the Super Bowl makes it on the strength of one specific play. And Richard Sherman made that play.
Okay, so his remarks came right after this play, just to put it in context. And then reporter Aaron Andrews approaches him, talks to him about it, and we get the bit of audio that we just heard. That was Sunday. Why are people still talking about it?
Because this is America, and we're crazy about the NFL. That's why. I would have thought interest in this would have died out a few hours later. It's 3 days later, and it was on CNN and MSNBC last night. People are still fascinated by this. It's America. What more can I say?
Well, you're right. You wrote a piece about this, and you think that part of the reason people are so obsessed with the interview is that Sherman said what a lot of people want to say every day, but they can't. They want to crow that they're the best. And in people, there is a culture of talking smack when people compete. We don't see it on TV associated with professional sports. Why is the Muhammad Ali, I'm the number one thing kind of gone from sports on TV?
Yeah, there used to be a lot of bragging in sports. Muhammad Ali is the most familiar example, and I think there still is in prize fighting. Most professional sports now is corporate linked in some way. The NFL is a great sport, but it's a great sport that's a great medium for corporate advertising and is very closely linked to corporate America in many ways, beginning with the $25 million a year that Gatorade pays to make sure that it's Gatorade that's poured on the coach's head, not some other sports drink. So corporate America doesn't like emotion. This very visceral, he looks right into the camera and says, don't you ever talk about me in a very real and impulsive way. Most athletes are very carefully coached by media consultants to be cool and to act detached and to say all the right things. I thank my high school teachers. My opponents are the best. Thanks to God for my victory. Not to be emotional. He was emotional, and he'd kind of earned it. And I think people connected with it.
So, as a guy who was watching this on TV, like a lot of America was, what was your response when you heard him say that?
Oh, I just thought it was a little over the top. But he didn't hurt anybody. He didn't use any foul language. He was just a little bit over the top. If I were the Seattle coach, I would wish he hadn't said it exactly that way. But like I said, he didn't curse. He didn't say anything nasty.
And the conversation is continuing. There are people out there who are calling him villainous. Why do you think that is?
Well, as you know, Veronica, I've just published a book, The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America, which is about the American love affair, good and bad, with the sport and football. And the reason people are talking so much about this is that we're just total football addicts, And our drug is about to be taken away. There's only 2 weeks of it left. So we're talking about everything there is to talk about while there's still time.
Well, some of the reaction to that post-game interview, if you can call it an interview, I guess a rant is another word, but the reaction has been incredibly racist in some parts. How does race play into the conversation with what happened?
Well, you know, I've heard people say that the reactions are racist, but I have not myself heard any racist reactions. So I believe that this might have occurred, but I'm not positive what they're referring to.
Sherman said that he got responses that referenced the N-word, and he had said, I think it was in a piece I read on CNN, that he was especially disappointed because some of this stuff happened on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and it does seem as though there was some racist element to it. And let's just say that happened, you didn't see it, but what would you make of that?
Well, maybe, but I would say one of the good things about football is that football has created African-American heroes who are cheered for by white America as recently as a generation ago. That didn't occur, and now even white males in the old Confederacy states, even in South Boston, they cheer for black athletes. I think that's a great development. It only goes so far. 99.9% of African-Americans are not athletes, but as far as it goes, it's pretty good, and you know, otherwise, how do I know what he heard? So it's hard to speculate on what somebody else hears.
How normal is trash talk in football?
Sorry?
How normal is it for players to trash talk one another in football when they're on the field?
The trash talk to each other is constant. Some players are trash talkers. Some players are silent during the game. You're usually one or the other. And coaches generally coach players not to take the bait. If somebody else trash talks you, it's because they're trying to distract you from your own performance. And the best thing to do is just simply do it. No, don't reply. Don't say anything back. Don't try to out-talk them. Just act like they don't exist. And that, in fact, most players take that philosophy, at least at the NFL level. If you're down on field level where you can hear what's going on the field, you hear very little talking. But there are a few exceptions. Sherman's one. Michael Crabtree, the guy he got into it with, is one. There are a few guys in the NFL who are in sports, we would say a motor mouth, and the motor mouths tend to go on.
Now, the reporter who interviewed him, Aaron Andrews, she followed up on the first part of what he said and said, "Who was talking about you?" And you know, he says Crabtree was saying stuff. So, can we assume that those guys were kind of going at it right before the mic was turned on?
They might well have been. Yes, I mean, my guess is that they're going at it verbally with each other for the entire game. And when guys, you might not believe this, but when guys trash talk on the field, vulgarity is rare. Because if a referee certainly overheard the N-word being used, he would throw the flag regardless of who was the person using it. So trash talking is more about who's good and who's bad and who's going to cry and who's sorry and et cetera. And probably they were saying those things to each other the whole game. And at the end, it was Michael Crabtree who was crying.
Wow. So there's actually a code of morals for trash talk on the football field?
I wouldn't go all the way to morals. I just say nobody wants to get a flag. So there's things you can say and things that you can't say. And most players, although certainly not always, avoid saying the things that you'll get a flag for.
Well, what Sherman said, one thing that you write, and I think we can all agree on, is that he went off script. The post-game chat is generally supposed to be the really boring part of the game, right? So is it a way what he did, is it at all good for the sport?
I just think my bottom line on this would be that a week from now, no one will remember this. It's just interesting right now. If I was Pete Carroll, the coach of the Seahawks, I would wish he hadn't done that. You don't want anything at all that distracts your team from the purpose of winning the ultimate game in 10 days. And he went off script. Carroll would have much rather he said, you know, the 49ers are a great team. Crabtree's a great player. I just got my hand a little higher than his, and now we're going to New Jersey. If he'd said that, everybody would have been happy. But he's a human being. He said what he said.
But I guess if we're talking about interesting TV, if the NFL were a reality show, that would be the money scene where the guy really looks at the camera and says something unexpected.
Yeah, there was actually a little attempt to do this. And the USFL and the XFL, the two attempts over the last generation to create competitors to the NFL, tried to be more like that. They put microphones on people so you could hear them arguing, tried to start fights on the sideline, et cetera. And maybe there's a market for that, but I think there's a lot of objections to the way the NFL runs its finances and use of public money and to the kinds of examples it sets for young people. I detail them all my book, The King of Sports. But if you want to know, do they have a good business model? Yes, they have a great business model. And part of it involves athletes always being very polite in public.
How do you think Richard Sherman's post-game rant will affect the Super Bowl in a week and a half?
I don't think it'll have any effect at all. I mean, people might boo him when he runs out on the field, but that might not, even that, if it happens, it'll be over in 30 seconds.
Well, as you mentioned, Americans are about to have what you think is the number one drug, football, taken away. What do you think America's going to do in the months without the pigskin?
Well, unfortunately, the last 5 years of history say that as soon as the season is over, Americans start obsessing over the NFL draft, which comes 3 months later. Five straight years, the NFL draft, it's been in April, this year it's in May, but for five straight years, the NFL draft has been the highest-rated event on television in the month of April in the United States. And it isn't even football being played, it's just football being talked about is more popular than any crime drama or reality show or singing contest or anything else.
Why do you think Americans are so crazy for football?
Well, and the key thing is we're the only country that's crazy for gridiron style football. Football is the number one sport of the number one country in the world, and we're the only country where it's even played. It's played a little bit in Canada, but certainly nowhere else outside of Canada and the United States. And I think it's because only America could pull it off. Football is, of all team sports, it's the biggest, it's the most expensive, it's the loudest. It's the most complex. We're the country that went to the moon. We're the only country that could stage 1,000 football games. Well, if you include high school, is stage 20,000 football games per weekend every fall with the great complexity of football. We're the only country that can afford it. It's also the loudest sport. It's the nuttiest sport. It's the most superficial sport. Everything that's good and bad about the United States is wrapped up in that game, and that's why we're crazy about it.
Thanks so much for joining us, Greg.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Greg Easterbrook, contributing editor of The Atlantic and author of The King of Sports, Football's Impact on America. The Internet is often a hostile environment for women. With harassment, revenge porn, and even threats of death or rape, a number of women have come forward recently with harrowing stories about what they've encountered online and with little recourse.
Our next guest studies online hate and what, if anything, the legal system can do about it. Danielle Citron is a professor of law at the University of Maryland. Her book, Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, is due out later this year. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
So how hostile an environment is the Internet for women, would you say?
You know, I guess it depends on who one asks, but from, you know, I think a female perspective, it can be a really hostile place. And, you know, the empirical evidence tends to show that online harassment is a pretty pervasive problem. There are about 850,000 cases of stalking that are largely, you know, occurred by using network technologies. In the study of online harassment, there's a consistent set of statistics that over 75% of the victims are female. And what I've found in my work is that it's not just that it's the identity of the victims who are targeted, but it's the message that's sent. When individuals are targeted online, it's often in a very gendered and sexualized manner that's very demeaning. So the threats are often threats of sexual violence. The defamation often said, you know, people, there are lies spread about women, and it's often that they have sexually transmitted infections. They're prostitutes. So that the abuse isn't just that, it isn't just that the victims, their identities are more often female, though men can, of course, face online harassment, but that the message that's sent and the way in which we go about it is demeaning and shameful. And often reduces people to their kind of diseased sexual parts and is very sexually threatening.
Can you give us a couple of examples? Because this has happened, and there have been some high-profile instances of this kind of online bullying, harassment, rape threats over the past several years. Tell us, if you would, about a couple of them.
Oh, sure. And what's interesting, too, is that I'm so grateful for the attention to the issue. You know, in 2007, and I'll give you an example, Kathy Sierra was attacked in 2007. And at the time, and I'll tell you a little bit about, you know, her experience, but at the time, there was hoopla about her case, and then it immediately died down. That is, we kind of woke up to the problem of online harassment that's very gendered and sexualized, but we sort of fell asleep. And it's not that the abuse stopped. It's continued and gotten worse. It's just, I think, I think it's really rewarding to see the press and the media engage in this issue in a really much more sustained manner. And we see sort of lawmakers running with it at the state level to address revenge porn. So I thought I'd just note that as we started. Mm-hmm. But okay, so Kathy Sierra in 2007, she was actually a very well-known a blogger who wrote about software programming. And she had a blog called Creating Passionate Users. And it was, according to Technorati, one of the top 50 most popular blogs from 2004 to 2007. And in 2007, she was attacked on her blog in the comment section, as well as receiving emails of gruesome threats of sexual violence. And I won't repeat them, but they were rape threats, threats of suffocation, very graphic descriptions of violence, both in the comment section as well as in emails she received. At the same time, she was targeted on two other blogs, group blogs, and there were pictures, doctored photographs of her put up online. In one, she looked like she was being suffocated by lingerie and screaming. And in the other, there's a picture of Kathy Sierra with sort of looking sideways and a noose beside her neck that was photoshopped in. And a commenter wrote, "The only thing Kathy Sierra is good for is her neck size." Now, she spoke up about the abuse on her blog. She was sort of set to speak at a technology conference in San Francisco, and she canceled speaking. She went to the Colorado police. They were like, "Don't leave your house, lock your doors." And she blogged about it, and she wrote about how frightened she was. And the response to her blogging about her experience was sort of a second wave of abuse. Trolls from the website 4chan went after her and sort of said, "Now that you're whining about, stop whining, Kathy Sierra," and spread her social security number, her home address, and a series of lies wow. about her all over the web. So because she spoke up, she was sort of punished, what she says is the crime of speaking out. And she closed her blog. She hasn't blogged anywhere since. She really stopped. She was an incredibly, you know, sought-after speaker. She stopped speaking around the country. Basically, the Colorado police gave up. They claimed technical ignorance and sort of gave up. They didn't spend the resources trying to figure out who threatened her. And it had a profound impact on her life.
And that seems to be a pattern that gets repeated over and over. You get these violent threats that involve sexualization, death, rape, on and on, and in as crude a fashion as you can possibly imagine and beyond. And it seems as though the woman often withdraws, that nothing happens, nothing comes of it. Why is that?
Because it says, you know, the idea... Certainly, I think the idea behind it is silencing. It's like, you're next, watch out, watch your back. And I think not only do female bloggers who are targeted get that message, but so many other people do. I mean, I think people go underground or they stop blogging or they write under a pseudonym or write under a male name because they just don't want to be attacked any further. And it basically ruins Google searches of people's names. I have talked to countless victims who, after I speak to them, I'll Google search their name, and it will be pages and pages of, you know, defamatory lies, threats, their naked photos, their home address, you know, the suggestion they're interested in sex. And so, as one victim told me, she's like, "I felt like she changed her name. She had to declare reputational bankruptcy because she had to disassociate herself with her online personality." Because employers, friends, you know, future dates would see. So, yes, it's a story I hear time and again. It's honestly depressing. You know, in writing this book, you know, I'll get an email every other day from someone, and the story is always the same.
And part of the problem seems to be that, you know, there are women who are raising consciousness about this stuff going on. And on the other hand, you see a response a lot of the time, including from some pretty high places, that this is, you know, what amounts to frat boy pranks. And there's nothing behind it. And women just kind of need to chin up and get on with it. Other women have even suggested, you know, that women should just put the trolls in their place and move on. Just be glad that they're being harassed at all, because it means the people who are threatening them are threatened.
Right. I mean, so that response is pretty pervasive. You know, on the one hand, you often hear law enforcement, especially at the local and rural level, the response to victims is just turn your computer off. Boys will be boys. If you ignore it, it will drop down in threads. It'll go away. there's nothing we can do, and which is often not the case. But the idea is that the victims can withdraw from online life and not be hurt by it, and that's just absolutely wrong, right? That our network technologies are the key to how we live, our online identities, our offline reputations. It's one and the same.
Our guest right now is Danielle Citron. She's a law professor and author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace, and we're talking about harassments and threats against women online.
We're talking about anti-woman harassment and threats online.
And you can join the conversation. Have you been the subject of online threats or harassment? Has someone close to you? And do you think it should be a crime to threaten or harass people online? And if not, who is accountable? And what do you think it is about online culture that leads people to make these threats? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Danielle, one of the suggestions that has been made to some of the women who've reported these threats and suggestions of violence is that they stay offline for a while, to lay low. What do you think? Is that a viable option?
I think it's just not an option in today's world. I mean, even if you, let's say you close down your social network profile and you stop blogging, I mean, the threats and the defamatory lies and privacy invasions are still going to appear online and Googleable in your name. So even if the sacrifice, of course, to the person is to withdraw from different online tools, they can't avoid the harm. It's not something you can walk away from when other people are searching your name, and especially for employment purposes.
Well, I want to go to a caller now. We've got Dan on the line from Menominee. Hi, Dan.
Hi there.
Hi. What do you think about online harassment?
Well, you know, there's an awful lot of ground to cover here, and I take my hat off to your guests for doing such a great job. Now, I work with kids, and I see this a lot in my classrooms, sort of the online bullying. And I see a lot of the same reactions where people say, well, you know, just don't go online and it'll leave, which is, of course, ridiculous. But I think that what this stems from is that at a very young age, kids and teenagers learn to interact in a very poor way. They learn to trash talk to each other without any adult supervision. So there is sort of an element of the fact that communication is just sort of like this. Now, that's certainly not an excuse or a reason. But I think as people age, a lot of young men view the internet and their video games and their programming as sort of their own little personal world. And when a woman makes herself known, it can often cause them, I guess you'd call it, some discomfort and sort of some spiky defensiveness. So I think that some of these people who engage in harassment probably view themselves as legitimately sort of defending their territory, which, again, is ridiculous. I don't want to use that as an excuse. So do I think this should be a crime? Well, of course, absolutely. Harassment should absolutely be a crime, but I think we have to be more cognizant of the fact that this harassment is happening points to a much, much deeper sociological problem, that we still have these deep, deep veins of sexism that, you know, in the when you're anonymous, all of a sudden can come out and, you know, shake their ugly fist.
All right. Well, thank you so much for those comments, Dan. There's a lot to think about there. Danielle, what about what Dan said about it sort of being a culture that develops for young men as they grow up online, and that they feel defensive about it, and they develop sort of their own code about defending it?
So I think, Dan, you're absolutely right that, you know, so much of this is a problem of social attitudes and culture, and that we've got to get at this at a really early age. That is, to teach all students that we've got to treat each other with respect, not kind of a one-time, you know, you have sort of cyber harassment or bullying training, but an ongoing conversation in schools, when incidents happen, to talk about it, not to be defensive and say doesn't belong to our school, it's not a conversation we have, and to have parents be as involved as they can be. You know, so often parents just sort of wipe their hands of their kids' technology use and say, I'm outpaced by the technology, I'm not going to get involved. And they really have to be. And that's not to say that as involved as a parent is, that nothing will happen to their kids online, because that's not true. I mean, it is absolutely the case that really none of us can protect ourselves from it. No matter what we do, someone decides to target us or cyberbomb goes after us. But when you ask the question, Veronica, like with Dan's insight about kind of boys seeing the internet or internet spaces as their own, and there's, you know, studies from MIT about the culture of gaming and online games that finds that there is this like deeply rooted misogynistic and homophobic and racist sort of gaming culture that is often kind of part of the bravado of gaming. And it can be overwhelming, and it drives people away from gaming. And that, I think, in part, it goes back to the thought that we need parents more involved. This is never going to be cured overnight. It's a conversation we've long been having. We had, as regard to domestic violence, sexual harassment in the workplace, we once thought both of those was a private family matter. We don't get involved. And sexual harassment in the workplace was, just personal relationships gone sour or a private perk of the workplace. And we, over time, saw them as social problems. And I think it's the same sort of cycle again. We have to see online harassment as a social problem, not as no big deal or frat boy nonsense, but a real serious problem. And I think it's going to take a whole lot of different, like, it's really complex, as Dan was underscoring, and it's going to take a whole lot of sources of attack of how we change our social norms online.
We're talking right now with Danielle Citron, a law professor at the University of Maryland, about anti-woman harassment and threats online. And we're wondering what you think about this. Have you encountered this? If you're a woman, have you ever felt threatened or like you were not being respected online? And what do you think should happen when there is harassment online of anyone? Who should be responsible? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And Danielle, I want to ask you about, you know, a counterexample right now. You know, we have seen in the past a couple of incidences of rapes that did occur, and there were, I guess, the sentiment among certain people that the authorities who were investigating the crimes were not responding properly. And so what happened was online communities formed together and they revealed in some cases who they thought to be the rapist. What about that sort of solution to the problem where you have people sort of coming to the defense of somebody else?
Right. So, you know, the Steubenville case, you're right, is such a perfect example of anonymous hackers kind of getting involved and putting the pressure on police officers in Pennsylvania to do something about it rather than kind of circling around the perpetrators, right, in a kind of code of silence. And what's interesting in the sad note is that the hacker who revealed the name of the, I guess, four football players who were involved in the young woman's rape has been charged with and indicted for computer hacking crimes. And so, you know, in some sense, it's the lesson of we shouldn't violate the law to help it vindicate it in other circumstances. And some of the problem is, and I think I'm more troubled by the kind of cyber mob effect that, you know, if a cyber mob goes after someone and then supporters go after the mobbers, it's kind of like a one-way ratchet to degradation. You know, it's like everyone is threatened and harassed, and it's just devolves into destruction. So I think, you know, it's often that in some respects we want, you know, victims to speak out against abuse, to feel like they can have a voice and respond. But, you know, sometimes naming and shaming attackers leads to much worse of a blowback on victims than we might imagine.
So what is the right thing to do for anyone, a man or woman, who is harassed, threatened, getting death threats on the internet? What should they do?
Right. I mean, I think the first response is to go to law enforcement. Terroristic threats of violence that are graphic and strike sort of immediate fear in someone's mind is a crime. It's a crime under state and federal law. Cyber stalking and cyber harassment often fall under criminal statutes for stalking and harassment. These laws aren't perfect. They often require sort of direct communications with victims. But you've got to go to law enforcement. And I'm not suggesting that there will be a terrific response. I mean, so much of my book is the story of we've got to change our social attitude so law enforcement gets it right, so they, you know, investigate complaints rather than just turn people away. But we can't give up on law enforcement. The more law is enforced, the more, you know, perpetrators will, or future perpetrators will get the message that this is serious. They have something to lose. It stays on your record forever. We, you know, we have legal tools. We have to use them. And I'm not saying law can do it all. It can do a little bit, but it should be, you know, victims often underreport both rape and other kinds of gendered violence, including online harassment. Victims underreport it, and they should go to law enforcement. As depressing as it might be, if they're turned away, they have to try. And so that's, I think, the first response. The second response is there may be civil claims that can be filed. And, of course, lawsuits are expensive. And if, let's say, someone doesn't have the resources, I mean, there are actors on the web, you know, and as you introduced the program, you were talking about, like, internet intermediaries and what role that they play. Sites like Facebook are really virtuous. To the extent that there is harassment on Facebook, they have a team, four offices of a safety team, you know, with hundreds of individuals working on and taking very seriously online harassment. So sometimes there is nothing you can do because the site operator you ask to take down the destructive lies and privacy invasions, they laugh. They're immune from liability, and they can say, too bad, so sad. We're not doing anything about it. But there are some, you know, really terrific online players like Facebook who will.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Danielle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Danielle Citron. She's a law professor at the University of Maryland and the author of Hate Crimes in Cyberspace. Now, our next guest is an astrophysicist who went searching for time travelers, not in deep space, but on social media.
Robert Nemeroff joins us now. He's a physics professor at Michigan Tech. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how did an astrophysicist find himself on Facebook and Twitter looking for time travelers?
Well, I've always been interested in that, and I have a summer research group of students, and so we meet a couple times a week, and one time a week we meet at my house and play poker. And so we're just talking about anything, you know, and time travel is a real big thing with Doctor Who and stuff, so it just came up. And so I posed to them the challenge, let's say time travelers were among us. How would you find them? And so this whimsical conversation just went on, and we came back, you know, the next week and talked about it more and more, and eventually we started becoming a bit of a impromptu research project. So we went searching. They knew a lot about social media. I knew a little bit about physics. So we put it together, and just for laughs, see if we could find time travelers on social media.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, essentially typing terms into search engines. The search engine built into Facebook and Twitter and Google, and trying to find information that people shouldn't have known about. For instance, people shouldn't be talking about Pope Francis in 2011. They shouldn't be talking about it. And if they are, that might be an indication that something's a little bit off, that maybe somebody knows something doesn't become knowledge for a couple of years. So we looked for any kind of indication of Pope Francis. And we couldn't find it. We also looked for Comet Ison before it became a bright comet. Couldn't find that either. So we can't prove anything, but we have an indication that you can't time travel to the past, unlike happens in science fiction all the time.
And you're in charge of NASA's Astronomy Picture of the Day website. You used that in the time travel search, didn't you?
So a colleague of mine, Jerry Bunnell, and I, we write, edit, and produce the Astronomy Picture of the Day. So that has a search engine. And so instead of just people posting content or tweeting things, maybe somebody was typing something into a search engine. So we looked on Google, but Google wasn't that satisfying. There were ways it could have slipped through. So we also looked on the search engine what terms were submitted to the Astronomy Picture of the Day to see if Comet Ison was being searched for before it appeared. And again, couldn't find it.
I don't know. Were you discouraged? Do you think this means there are not time travelers among us?
Yeah, I never really thought there were time travelers to the past before, but I am a bit more discouraged now because this was a relatively clean experiment. I mean, if we had found something, it would have been a big deal. We would have had to check it and double check it and triple check it and things like that. But we just didn't find anything that would indicate that backwards time travel, that you can't go to the past, apparently.
It could mean that the people of the future think social media is so passé that when they come back in time, they don't bother with it.
That's true, but let's say the guy next door keeps coming outside and talking about, you know, Pope Francis. Mm. You might tweet about it.
Ah, good point.
I think it's more likely to be third party than them tweeting directly.
Now, you did find one premature mention of Pope Francis, though, didn't you?
Yeah. So searching through, we did have a couple of false positives. That one in Pope Francis, somebody posted to their blog, and there was a tweet that highlighted it, that there might be, in the future, a Pope Francis in the next couple of months, because they knew that there would be a new pope. But after looking at it very carefully, this person wasn't really predicting that. They weren't claiming to be a time traveler. They weren't really saying they knew the future. They were just offhand speculating different possibilities, and that was one.
Yeah, but the first rule of being a time traveler is don't admit you're a time traveler.
Well, where is that written? So that's true.
I don't know, actually.
Find time travelers that way, but maybe there's extroverted time travelers. You know, if I was a time traveler, I'd be making mistakes all over the place. I'd be like, oh, no, shouldn't have done that. So maybe time travelers are human and they make mistakes.
Science fiction is packed with stories of time travel. As a physicist, what is your take on whether it would be possible to travel backward in time somehow?
Well, you can travel to the future. That's allowed by Einstein's special relativity. Traveling to the past is also basically allowed in general relativity, but it's people, and I included, don't think it's really possible. We think there's some unknown law of physics that comes in that says that can't happen.
The law is unknown.
Well, because it's not currently encoded in Einstein's general theory of relativity. There are solutions in Einstein's general relativity where you can come back to your timeline in the past before you left. They're formal mathematical solutions, but nobody really believes that they're true. They think there's some kind of chronology protection conjecture or law that would come in and stop that.
So,
incidentally, I'm not the only one to wonder if time travelers are coming back. Stephen Hawking held had a party for time travelers a couple years ago and issued the invitations after the party, but nobody showed up.
Does this mean you're giving up on this, you and your students, or are you going to investigate different avenues looking for time travelers?
Well, this is sort of a whimsical project. I think basically the idea is out there now, so we don't really have current plans to keep going. But then again, we didn't have backdoor access to major search engines like Google and Facebook. So we kept running into problems with Facebook with advertisements. So where the new advertisement would be placed on an old piece of information. So maybe people who work or have access, better access to Facebook than the average person does, or better access to Google search than the average person does, maybe they can go in and do it better than we did and use different search terms too. But I don't see that we're really going to be continuing on this. I think we did what we could do. We had our fun, and now we might move on to something else.
All right. Well, Robert, thank you so much for joining us, and good luck with your next project.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
That was Robert Nemeroff, professor of physics at Michigan Tech.